Today, we are reviewing Circulatory Health as a Coherent System, a deeply researched paper that redefines cardiovascular health not merely as the absence of disease, but as the sustained stability of a multi-scale system spanning from early development to public policy. Let's pivot immediately into the feedback, because we have a lot of structural ground to cover today to really elevate this material.
Yeah, I am ready to dive right in. The concepts here are, they're highly sophisticated. So our goal today is to really sharpen that conceptual edge, make sure it translates powerfully to the actual audience.
Right. So we're going to start by looking at the core premise of the paper, which is this shift from a reactive downstream model to a proactive coherence model. As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is that modern medicine is basically caught in this downstream trap.
Yes. Exactly.
Like, we literally wait until a patient's physiological reserve is just completely depleted, and only then do we apply this massive force to stabilize them, which obviously yields diminishing returns.
Right. And the text does a really thorough job of explaining the biological mechanics of that trap. Like, it frames the circulatory system not just as, a mechanical pump and pipes, but as this multi-scale adaptive network.
Mm-hmm.
So when a patient arrives with late-stage pathology like resistant hypertension or heart failure, the system's adaptive options have already narrowed. The vasculature has permanently stiffened. The heart muscle has structurally remodeled.
Right.
So applying heavy pharmacological force at that late stage is, it's incredibly inefficient.
Yeah, it's like trying to force a rigid system to bend, which usually just causes something else to break.
Exactly.
And in contrast to that, the text proposes this wu-wei or minimal force intervention principle. The idea being to shape the upstream conditions to preserve the system's margin of elasticity, right? Before it completely loses its ability to adapt.
Which is philosophically rigorous. If you can intervene early when the system still has high plasticity, it requires barely any force to nudge it back into a stable state.
Yeah, and I agree that it is a beautiful architectural blueprint for a new health system. But I have to wonder how the construction worker, like the frontline clinician with a strict 15-minute patient window, is supposed to lay the bricks.
Yeah, that's the real tension.
Because it feels like we are asking them to build a cathedral while they are actively trying to stop a flood. They're looking at a patient who is already caught in that downstream trap.
The material introduces a profound theoretical shift from intervention to condition design, but it could further bridge the gap between high-level systems thinking and immediate clinical application.
Right. Okay.
The weakness here is that while concepts like minimal force intervention and, preserving margin are conceptually sound, a frontline practitioner dealing with the gritty constraints of everyday clinical practice might really struggle to operationalize this framework.
Yeah, totally.
The theory currently feels slightly disconnected from the reality of the exam room. It leaves the reader wondering how to actually apply these macro-level insights during a micro-level, heavily constrained patient encounter.
Right. Because if I am a doctor reading this on a Sunday night, I need to know what I am doing differently on Monday morning. Otherwise, the philosophy just, it just stays on the page.
Exactly. So the suggestion is to integrate micro-level clinical operationalizations of the coherence model to complement the macro-level policy and governance suggestions. We need to show, rather than just tell, what this paradigm shift actually looks like in the hands of a practitioner under real-world time constraints.
Okay, I like that. So what would that actually look like on the page?
A concrete example would be to present a highly tangible side-by-side case study. Take a standard checkup versus this new coherence-guided checkup. Let's say a patient presents with rising blood pressure. The text could map out the standard dashboard response first.
Which, typically involves an immediate escalation of antihypertensive medication.
Right. Because the clinical goal under the current model is just to force the metric back into the normal range.
Regardless of why the system is generating the pressure in the first place.
Exactly. It's symptom management.
Yeah, just putting tape over the check engine light.
Right. But in the parallel scenario, the text could demonstrate what preserving the system's margin actually sounds like in dialogue. So instead of writing a prescription in minute 3, the clinician uses specific, targeted questions to map the patient's systemic reserve.
Oh, interesting.
They might assess the allostatic load by inquiring about, say, sleep architecture, occupational stress, or the local nutritional environment.
Okay, but we need to explain the mechanics of why those specific questions actually matter biologically, right?
Exactly. The text could explicitly link that sleep loss to the dysregulation of cortisol rhythms, which actively drives the stiffening of the vasculature. By making that connection right there on the clinic floor, it proves that minimal force isn't just some vague concept.
Mm-hmm. It is a targeted inquiry into the variables that are actively generating the disturbance.
I see. I can see how that really clarifies the clinical conversation. But wait, I mean, isn't a critic just going to argue that assessing sleep architecture and occupational stress takes way more than 15 minutes? It sounds like we are just adding more diagnostic burden to an already exhausted doctor.
Yeah, that is a very fair critique. And it's exactly why another concrete example would be to include an actionable one-page clinical checklist in the appendix.
Oh, a checklist. Yeah. This checklist could be designed to help doctors rapidly assess adaptive options and system load before they escalate therapeutic force. It would give the clinician a highly structured, rapid-fire way to evaluate whether the patient still has the biological margin to absorb a low-force intervention.
Like addressing a specific environmental factor.
Right. Before the doctor resorts to high-force, low-reversibility medical treatments, is the connection between systems theory and clinical practice fully established in the material, or is that an area to potentially bolster?
I'd say currently, the text leans so heavily toward the macro theory that this micro-level connection is definitely the area to bolster first.
Yeah, I agree.
And actually, addressing those environmental constraints leads us really logically into the next layer of the paper. Because if we are telling frontline doctors to look for this hidden structural load, they simply can't do it if the patient's environment is actively masking that load.
Exactly.
So let's look closely at the section discussing the commercial determinants of health and the distortion field. Because this is, it's arguably the most intellectually ambitious section of the text.
It really is. It posits that commercial entities, you know, those producing ultra-processed foods, tobacco, or digital platforms optimized for attention, they do not just passively exist as some neutral background environment.
Right.
They are active generators of physiological disturbance.
And the text explains the mechanism of that disturbance super well. Like ultra-processed foods trigger inflammatory cascades, and digital platforms cause chronic sympathetic nervous system arousal.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find most compelling here is how these entities distort our perception of the damage. Through marketing, narrative framing, economic incentives, actual system risk gets completely normalized.
Yes.
It's like trying to navigate a ship using a map. But a commercial entity is actively moving the lighthouses and changing the compass polarity. You think the system is functioning normally, but the feedback loops have been manipulated to hide the accumulating structural drift.
That's fascinating. What are the potential limitations or counterarguments to that idea?
Well, the immediate overwhelming pushback from a significant segment of readers is going to be about individual agency.
Oh, definitely.
If I am playing devil's advocate, a critic is going to read this section and say, look, nobody is forcing you to eat ultra-processed foods. People need to take personal responsibility for their habits. You cannot blame the commercial environment for a lack of individual willpower.
Right. The exploration of commercial determinants and the distortion field is a standout concept that could be significantly strengthened by preemptively addressing counterarguments regarding individual agency.
Mm.
The weakness is that the text powerfully argues that commercial determinants heavily emphasize structural constraints over individual choice, but it leaves a massive rhetorical gap.
Yeah, it really does.
It just does not explicitly address the inevitable pushback from policymakers or industries who champion personal responsibility or who view structural health interventions as nanny state overreach. By leaving this counter-narrative unaddressed, the material leaves itself highly vulnerable to being dismissed by readers who hold differing ideological views on market regulation.
It is a critical vulnerability, because if you are proposing a health-in-all-policies governance model to regulate these commercial determinants, you absolutely have to defend against the argument that your policies are stripping away free choice.
Exactly. So the suggestion is to fortify this section by incorporating a direct mechanical analysis of the tension between structural design and individual agency. The author must actively dismantle the false dichotomy between structural intervention and personal freedom, neutralizing the main argument that detractors will inevitably use against this framework.
Okay, but how do they execute that dismantling practically? Like, do they just argue that willpower is a myth?
Oh, no, not at all, because that would instantly alienate the reader. A much stronger concrete example is to explicitly acknowledge the individual responsibility argument within the text, but reframe it as a deliberate, manufactured symptom of the distortion field itself.
Oh, I see.
The author can explain that structural constraints are intentionally marketed as personal moral failures by commercial entities in order to deflect regulatory scrutiny.
Wow. So you expose the strategy behind the narrative by showing the reader that the personal choice argument was actually engineered by the entities causing the disturbance, you completely neutralize its rhetorical power.
Yes, exactly. But you have to prove that with evidence. So another concrete example to achieve this would be to add a brief historical case study on information asymmetry. The early history of tobacco regulation is the perfect analog here.
Oh, that's a great example.
Right? For decades, the tobacco industry successfully weaponized the personal choice narrative to stall policy. They argued that adults were freely choosing to smoke. It was only when early regulation exposed the corporate distortion, the hidden engineering of nicotine levels to maximize addiction, that the public realized their biological choices had been structurally manipulated from the start.
That is a phenomenal parallel. The author could use that case study to prove that structural intervention does not restrict individual agency. Rather, by clearing the distortion field and eliminating the information asymmetry, structural policy actually restores true individual agency.
Exactly.
It literally gives the consumer their autonomy back.
It frames the policy intervention not as an imposition of restrictive rules, but as the restoration of a transparent marketplace. It is a highly persuasive angle that would completely bulletproof that section against the most common ideological criticisms.
Right. Okay, so if we successfully navigate this distortion field and actually implement these structural policies, we need a way to measure our success, right?
We do.
We have to prove that the intervention actually reduced the hidden biological load on the population. And this brings us to the author's proposed solution, the structural altimeter. Okay, so what I really like about this part is the stark contrast it draws between how we currently measure health and how a complex system actually fails.
That contrast is essential to the thesis. Because right now, we manage public health entirely using dashboard metrics. You know, things like blood pressure averages, body mass index, mortality rates, and emergency room hospitalizations.
But as the text rightly points out, these are extreme lagging indicators. I mean, the body will fiercely compensate for years to keep blood pressure normal or blood sugar stable right up until the exact moment it permanently breaks.
Exactly.
Navigating public health by these dashboard metrics is literally like driving a car by only looking at the wake behind you. You only know where you have been, and you only see the damage long after the system has failed.
Which brings us to the proposed alternative. Instead of waiting for the break, the text proposes an altimeter that tracks structural drift early. It focuses on metrics like variability across populations and recovery time following a perturbation or stressor.
Which makes perfect sense in the realm of systems theory. A healthy system is highly variable and recovers quickly. A sick system is rigid and recovers slowly.
Right.
But I have to push back on the feasibility of this for the actual audience. Does a municipal policymaker actually have access to this kind of altimeter data today? Or is the author just writing a wish list for a future decade?
Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of a data scientist or an urban planner?
Yeah, because an urban planner would read this and say, look, I understand that hospitalizations are a lagging indicator, but if I am supposed to measure structural drift tomorrow morning to justify funding a new green space, what exact spreadsheet am I opening?
Exactly. The distinction between traditional dashboard metrics and a proactive structural altimeter is a brilliant analytical lens, yet the operational specifics of this altimeter remain somewhat abstract and could be pushed further into immediate viability.
Yeah.
The weakness here is that while the text correctly points out that static dashboard metrics
miss early structural drift. The proposed altimeter indicators, such as variability and recovery time, are introduced too broadly. Policymakers and health systems will need to know precisely what existing data feeds into this altimeter to justify reallocating millions of dollars from downstream care to upstream condition design right now.
Because without that concrete operationalization, the altimeter just remains a compelling metaphor rather than a bureaucratic tool.
Exactly. We need to prove to the reader that we do not have to wait 10 years to invent new measurement tools.
Right.
So the suggestion is to ground the altimeter concept in existing accessible data infrastructures or emerging technologies. The text must prove to the policymaker that this is not a theoretical exercise, that the capability to build the structural early warning system is actually already sitting on their desk.
I agree, but what does that look like practically? If we are trying to measure physiological recovery time across a population, how do we do that without putting a million people in a clinical trial?
One highly actionable concrete example would be to point to the aggregation of population-level wearable technology data. I mean, millions of people already wear smartwatches and fitness trackers that continuously monitor heart rate variability, or HRV.
Oh, wow. And HRV is a direct biological proxy for adaptability. High variability means the autonomic nervous system is flexible. Low variability means the system is locked in a chronic stress state.
Precisely. Because it measures the literal recovery time from physiological and psychological stress. The text could suggest utilizing anonymized, macro-level wearable data as a direct proxy for systemic reserve across different postal codes.
That's brilliant.
Right? A city could partner with tech companies to view an aggregated dashboard of HRV drops in specific neighborhoods. This would perfectly operationalize the concept of measuring early structural drift before a single clinical diagnosis of hypertension is ever made.
That is an incredibly potent idea. I do see a potential limitation, though. A policymaker might argue that wearable data is inherently skewed toward wealthier demographics who can actually afford the devices. How does the author get around that blind spot?
That is where the cross-referencing of existing municipal data comes in. Another concrete example for improvement would be to design a mock altimeter report and include it in Appendix C.
Okay.
Instead of just talking about cross-sector alignment, the author could visually demonstrate it. Imagine a mock report showing how a city council could cross-reference socioeconomic housing indices, noise pollution maps, and real-time ambulatory service data.
Oh, I see. So if a new urban transport policy is implemented, or like a major highway is diverted, the city can track the real-time changes in sleep disruption complaints, noise levels, and minor ambulatory calls in that specific district.
Yes. Providing a visual, step-by-step example of this data synthesis would show urban planners exactly how to evaluate the hidden circulatory impact of non-health policies in real time. It moves the concept of the altimeter out of the abstract realm of systems biology and translates it directly into the language of municipal governance.
It transforms a philosophical concept into an immediate bureaucratic instrument. And in the world of policy, if you want to change the system, you have to provide the instrument. If you just provide the philosophy, the status quo will easily ignore it.
Absolutely. The foundational architecture of this material is undeniably strong. It correctly identifies the core failures of the modern medical paradigm. By addressing these operational gaps and anticipating the ideological friction, the real-world impact of the work will be vastly magnified.
Significant ground today, moving from the macro-level theory down to the highly specific mechanics of clinical and policy execution. To briefly recap our primary recommendations for the author, first, ground the high-level coherence theory with micro-level clinical scenarios. Show exactly how a frontline practitioner can operationalize minimal force intervention within existing constraints by mapping a patient's systemic reserve. Second, bulletproof the distortion field argument by directly tackling the counter-narrative of individual agency. Use historical examples like tobacco regulation to prove that structural policy actually restores choice rather than restricting it. And third, make the structural altimeter immediately actionable by tying it to specific modern data streams, such as population-level wearable metrics and cross-referenced municipal data.
Right.
We strongly encourage the listener to implement these structural adjustments and submit the revised work back in for another critique.
The vision outlined in this material is vital for the future of public health. Now it simply needs the granular instructions to help the world actually build it. We leave you with this final thought. To prevent the flood, we must stop staring at the water level and start inspecting the integrity of the dam.